Hi, everybody. So today I'm gonna talk to you about avalanches and dynamical phase transition. In the system I have been studying during my PhD, so it's reaction waves, not in adverse flow, but like more general disordered flow. But we realized at some point that when the flow is adverse, we can observe this kind of phenomena. And initially, this work was motivated by growing phenomena in presence of disorder, which leads to beautiful scale invariant structures, which could be either in industrial processes or natural phenomena. And more specifically, we were interested in what we call autocatalytic reaction. So those reactions are very specific because they present a feedback loop. So basically, those reactions, if we have a species A and a species B reacting with each other, they will generate an extra B species. So this is a very generic model for representing autocatalysis. And so now this extra B can be reused to sustain the reaction. So basically, as long as we add one B in the system, the whole reaction will keep going until all the A have disappeared. And so here I give an example of Belousov-Zhepotinsky oscillations, where we have periodic reaction waves. And so these kind of processes, chemical processes, actually are leading to nonlinear chemical kinetics.
What sets the length scale of this distance between the wave front?
I don't know. I'm not, so I haven't worked on this reaction specifically.
Okay.
I will show what I have done, so. But yeah, so these oscillations are quite rich and interesting. And so this kind of phenomena lead to self-organizing patterns and are very present in living systems and other biological processes. So the very general frame is that those systems are represented by reaction diffusion equation, where if we represent the concentration of species B here as being U, this reaction depends on two terms. We have a diffusion term, which is responsible of mixing the species, and a reaction term. So in the case of an autocatalytic process, let's say a simple nonlinearity can be represented by here this term here of order 2. And this nonlinear term will lead to extra production of species B at a certain location. So we have the coupling between those two effects, a mixing effect, and an effect which announces the concentration of one species. So this equation, I mean, precisely with this second order nonlinearity, have been studied in the 1930s by Fisher and Kolmogorov in the context of spread gene spreading in biological systems. And so they have found a solution to this equation, and it can present a stationary solution, which leads to progressive wave solution. And in that case, what we have is a concentration profile, which will basically propagate with a constant velocity and will keep a stationary shape. And so the velocity of this reaction wave only depends on two things here, the reaction rate R, which is here, and the diffusion constant. And nothing else will is here influencing this, this dynamics. And so the question is, now we have those nice self-sustained wave. What happens if we introduce some kind of noise in the system? How these dynamics will be perturbed? And a way to introduce noise in a chemical reaction is actually to, the one we have chosen actually, is to create a disordered flow of reactive solution. And this way we can have a kind of disorder in the system. And so Today, I'm going to present you the experimental setup I've been working on. Then I will briefly present the dynamics of those forms when they are coupled to high flow strength. I will explain the frozen pattern formation phenomena. And hopefully, I will have time to present those avalanches phenomena in this system. And I will conclude. So the experimental system is based on iodide acid arsenious reaction. So I should not drink it, obviously, but I still can use it without harm, I hope. I've been using it for 3.5 years. So, and it's autocatalytic in iodide ion. So this is what is playing the role of the specie B. And the difference with the FKPP model I just showed in the introduction is that we have here a third order term. So it's not exactly the same equation. It's a third order nonlinearity. However, we can again end up with a stationary solution and observe those waves. So I haven't precised it, but so the difference with the Belousov-Zapotinsky reaction is we use this reaction in a single pulse regime. So we have only one wavefront propagating, not several, one behind each other.
Excuse me, this nonlinear term.
Yeah.
So it has right asymptotic for small c and for c going to one, and in between is just interpolating formula.
I mean, what this term is doing is, yeah, it's basically when you have c equals zero, it's fastly converging to, yeah, c equal one. That's the shape I was, that's actually, yeah, leading to.
Can you go back one?
Yeah.
The green color is which component?
Iodide.
That's the H3AS4?
No, I yeah.
I'm looking at the green as the I minus.
Yes. Okay. Yes, exactly.
And that's what C is.
So that's slightly more complicated. This is what we call. Like this is the final reaction equation. Actually, there are several reactions going on, one after one. So there are two more specifically. And so we start here. Then there are intermediate species produces. And then those intermediate these intermediate species will produce those final species. And I'm just writing the result.
What is C? What about this concentration you see? What is this? Is
I minus C is the autocatalyst concentration. So that's, sorry, I maybe should have precised this. Yeah, that's the concentration of. So this is playing the role of specie B. And this is what is not existing in the system at the beginning. This is what we add to initiate the reaction. And this is what will multiplicate. And the way we detect it actually is based on iodine production during the transient chemical reaction. Transiently, we have some iodine molecules produced. And by adding polyvinyl alcohol, which is a kind of starch, this will react and get this red color in presence of iodine. So this is the red front we see here. And then the yellow and the blue are due to another component we have add to change color when the pH change color, because the reaction also will change the pH. And so before it's less, is more basic, and after it's more acid. So there are two kinds. And we can see that the front definition is like slightly different depending on which. So this is the beginning, but once we have reached the stationary regime, we can see that there is a slight difference between the two way to measure the fronts, but it's very close. So this way, we can also see that the reaction is occurring in a very sharp space. And so in this reaction, we will also have a stationary solution. And the typical chemical wave velocity we have is 10 microns per second, so it's very slow. And the width is about 100 micron. And so all these things are constant in this system. So to create the spatially disordered flow, we have used an immersed granular medium. So we have a mix of 50% 1.5 millimeter and 2.5 millimeter beads to avoid any kind of crystallization in the system. And they are packed between two plates. So we have a helical cell. And I make sure that the packing is dense. So I shake the cell several times so we don't have any gap or any large heterogeneity in this system. And the way it works is we entirely fill this cell with a reactive solution. And then we can either soak or inject some solution here from the top, connected to a syringe pump. And this will create, we can have two configurations of mean flow direction, which will be either upward or downward. And to start the chemical reaction, so this is entirely filled with reactive solution. And then we dip it in a tank here, which contains some of the product solution. So this will initiate the reaction at the bottom. And we have, in all I will show, the reaction is always propagating upward.
How thick is the
UV cell? Oh, the thickness, yes, good question. It's about 4 millimeter. So it's not one-dimensional. It's close to one dimension because we will have maximum two beads in the cell.
Did you like that?
Yes, because I'm not a very big specialist. Other people can answer actually, but I believe that when we do a packing, one-dimensional packing, the dispersion can be quite different. It's not exactly the same as if we have a real porous medium where we, instead of having only one bead, we will have the pores will be the result of kind of small three-dimensional packing.
You want to make sure the reaction would take place. Is that interesting? Hmm? You want to make sure that this catalytic reaction would take place.
No, I think the reason for that is more because we wanted to reproduce something closer to an actual porous medium than something with just like obstacle flow between the beads.
So maybe it's more homogeneous in the thin direction rather than having particles with huge channels on either side.
Exactly, exactly. That's one of the reasons you have this channeling in the one layer packing case, exactly. Yeah. And so this is what happens when we initiate the reaction at the bottom. And
since in the cartoon, I'm led to believe that advection will be important because you have little arrows going through.
Yeah,
to indicate the direction.
This one?
The
yeah, this is.
Is advection important now or not?
No, this is a scheme. So
the arrows are just directions at the front would move or something.
Yeah, the packing is very dense, so all the beads are touching each other, and the pores are very small. But still, the pore size is larger than the chemical thickness. It's not. We don't have mixing of the reaction before the reaction happen inside the pore at the pore scale. So still, the reaction front is still defined inside the pore, because otherwise we will start to introduce an extra mixing of the species, because the reaction doesn't have the time to occur before it goes from one pore to the other. And in that case, the dynamics of the reaction can be different. It's actually different. So that's also one parameter someone can play on. We have decided to take larger pore to avoid this extra mixing effect, so that the mixing is only due to the dispersion of the flow and not the dispersion plus mixing of the reactive before the reaction happen.
Did you try other configurations?
Not systematically. I have done experiments and I see that the front chemical front velocity without and with flow is different than this case. But then for some experiments have been done actually by just testing what is the mean reaction wave velocities through glass beads of different sizes, like very small, then larger, larger, larger. And actually, so we have a kind of plateau where this velocity is constant when the pores are big enough. And when we start to reach this critical pore length of 100 micron, then this velocity starts to go down, and it's slowing down. So, but I haven't been doing this in this experiment. I have just used one of the size in this plateau regime. And so what we observe, we want any flow, if we start the reaction, so at the bottom of a cell, is basically this reaction waveform propagating with its own velocity. So the chemical velocity here is slightly less than 10 microns because of the tortuosity. The mean velocity is slightly slower. It's like, I would say, 80% of the chemical reaction velocity within the media, outside the media. And what we can see here is, also, I start with a rough shape. When there is no flow, the shape of this chemical front is relaxing towards something much more smooth.
This roughness is due to what?
So the roughness is because I, at the beginning, I shortly and rapidly suck the front inside, some of the product. So then there is some product inside and the chemical reaction starts. And so there is a bit, can be a bit noisy. So in all experiments, I make sure that I wait long enough so this relaxation has occurred. So I'm not starting with a front which is already got its own roughness. But still, this shape actually has a kind of roughness.
Is it related to KPC or?
Yes. So that's basically the nonlinear term of KPZs. Play like the chemical reaction is playing this role in this system. And so the other thing to check here is also to characterize the disorder in this system. And to do so, I have performed some tracer dispersion experiments. So I basically inject some dyed fluid inside the porous media. And then I measure the position of this tracer front. And here, I have report the position of this front in function of, so at different time steps. And in color code, I have indicated the local front velocity. And so we can see that the tracer front seems to fluctuate, and we can infer from both measurements, the fluctuation correlation length, so which is the parallel dispersivity here in, for the porous media. And this is about the mean bit size. So there isn't any long-range correlation in this system. Everything is fluctuating about the mean bit size scale.
But still, you can have fast velocities, but it's just you have those avalanches, which are typically the size of the pole.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But still, you can have very fast when you're passing the pole.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, at the pore scale, there are large fluctuations. Exactly. And if I look at the PDF of this velocity measured with tracer, I found here a log normal shape, which is quite common in homogeneous porous media flow velocity fields. So nothing specific in this system is happening. So it's quite well understand disorder, I would say. So what is the front dynamics when there is in presence of flow? So in presence of flow, as I mentioned earlier, we have two configurations possible. Mean flow, which is in the same direction as the chemical reaction, and mean flow, which is opposite to the chemical reaction direction. And so what happens is we can see that the front shape are now quite different, and we have those local fluctuations appearing here. So the front is no more smooth and doesn't have this stationarity. And in the case of strong adverse flow, so the front is going downward, is fluctuating also. But we can notice that there is a kind of macroscopic scale shape in this case. And so we will see in the next part what this shape are reminiscent of. And two things we can do to quantitatively characterize those fluctuations is to measure the Fronthe spatial and temporal fluctuations. And so the spatial fluctuations are characterized by measuring the height fluctuations around their mean position at a given time t for the position of the front. And the other measurement I'm doing is I look at the mean fluctuation, at the temporal fluctuation of a point on the front during time. So that's the other measurement I'm doing, and this is.
Are these setting up macroscopic flows at all? What's moving? Is there anything macroscopic in there? Like, is there any flows?
Mass flow. The fluid.
If I put a tracer in there.
Yeah.
Some macroscopic tracer would have been.
Yes, so. I'm not sure, but I think that's what I was showing here.
Just wondering if that was a chemical.
So. This is the tracer front. So this is when I basically suck the fluid from the top, and I will have some dyed fluid which go in. So everything is immersed. There isn't two-phase flow. It's everything is filled up with fluid. And I just here look at the interface between a non-colored and colored fluid. And this is what is giving me the this is the way I measure the mean flow velocity and those fluctuations.
But if the when the flow is off and the chemical reaction is going, that front is moving,
yeah.
There's no mass flow.
No.
That's
no.
Just chemical.
Exactly. I didn't get it. And then what we see here is the coupling between two of these phenomena. So both this reaction without any mass flow and the flow I showed with the tracers. Yes. So back to the fluctuation measurement. So we can characterize the roughness by determining the standard deviation of the height fluctuation around its mean position at a given spatial interval. And if we determine this function for different scales, then in case of scale invariance, we expect that we will have a power law in delta x, and the exponent alpha here would be the roughness.
Mm-hmm. Don't you have any problem? It seems like you have overhangs or close to overhangs.
Yes,
and
I do.
Then what do you do? Because for such analysis, it's a I mean, of course, you will have an influence of
sure.
Of the way you decide to
define the front.
Define your front.
Yeah, I agree with that. I have, for this analysis, I would say the overhang might take place here. You know, here there is a strong fluctuation.
Yeah, just a sharp or
yeah.
Straight line.
So there isn't that much in this kind of front. There are other, I have looked at this overhang.
It was just on your movies, it seems that it was not that easy to define
it.
It's the way you decide.
Here. So there are small overhangs, I agree.
But this is a small scale phenomenon, right? And
you have clearly overhangs, and then it will happen strongly. I mean, when you have a sharp line, on the scaling of the scaling analysis that you were about to show, it does a strong influence for sure.
So you take the highest points.
So actually, no. What I have been doing is, so I realized that, and I also realized that those overhangs are giving these vertical things, and so if I measure. So what I'm doing is actually I'm measuring the roughness of the front at each time steps. And when those structures appear, if they're like overhangs appearing, I see that this roughness will change. This is affected. But so what I do is I place myself, for example, to define this, I have looked at the roughness of the front in this regime. Like, I don't put myself too far where those overhangs would eventually appear, so I'm not influenced by those vertical phenomena. And they're not that much present. So they are present when the flow strengths become very strong. And so the movie I'm showing is actually a quite strong flow strength, but if I'm at more moderate, I can have a large enough window where I don't have those big overhangs. but that's an important point. I agree on that. And so for both configuration here, for like upward, like co-current flow and adverse flow when the front is going down, I can measure so the spatial fluctuations, and I found something which is quite similar in both regimes. And if I do the same for the temporal fluctuations, I can also I find something which is also quite close to each other for both regimes. And so in high flow strength, basically we observe some exponents which are in good agreement with the KPZ model. And so those exponents have been also so the KPZ model maybe I should explain a little bit, or yeah. So this is basically a grow. So it's an equation which represents a simple grow phenomena in the case of here a nonlinearity. So it's the simplest nonlinearity we can introduce here is the second order nonlinearity, and it depends on the gradient, the transversal gradient of the front. And so we have a relaxation term is which is a Laplacian here of the front, which depends on the constant, which could be either the a diffusion term, or it could be other dissipation term. And we have also here a noise term, which is stochastic, so it depends on position and time, and so this is a Gaussian noise. And we have the driving force. And so this model, the prediction of this model have been observed in a few other experiments, which are actually all quite different from each other. So this has been observed in combustion front, in liquid crystal turbulent phase transition, in cell bacterial colonies growth, and more recently also in colloidal suspension drying. And so where this universality come from in our system? So this is something we can answer actually if we look at the equation which is used to describe both kind of autocatalytic reaction front. So the Econol approximation is also used, for example, in combustion physics. And so here we have this equation tells us that the direction and the value of the mean, the local front velocity depends on three terms, on the curvature here and the diffusion of the autocatalyst, the chemical reaction velocity, and the projection of the local flow toward the normal to the interface. So this is the approximate equation which is used to describe those autocatalytic phenomena. And so if we perform a projection of this equation on x and y axis and do a small gradient in the small gradient limit, we can end up with this equation. And so if we look at closely to this equation and compare it term by term to the KPZ equation, we can see that similar ingredients are present in this in this equation. So we have here the Laplacian, so which is the diffusion of the autocatalyst. We have the nonlinear term, which is proportional to the chemical velocity. So this is what is responsible for the lateral growth. And here in the, so this is the vertical component of the flow velocity and the chemical reaction velocity. So both of them will give rise to my driving force, actually. It's basically the relative, so F will be the relative velocity between chemical reaction plus the mean flow velocity vertical component. So this is the driving force in my system. And the noise comes from the fluctuating part of my velocity V. So in that case, we can see that this is not like a stochastic noise, but it's like a quenching noise, because it depends obviously on the position of the front. And so in first approximation, we can neglect those two terms, because so here UX is very small compared to the vertical component of the front of the flow, sorry. And the other term is of higher order. But still, I mean, those terms might specifically, maybe this term can play a role, but at first approximation, it seems to be not of great importance. So another interesting phenomena which happens in this system is the formation of frozen pattern. And so this happens in adverse flow, and basically, if I put an adverse flow, which is not that strong, but the one I was showing previously, but slightly slower, we will have those sawtooth-shaped patterns formation in this system. And they actually happens for not only one value of the mean flow velocity, but like a certain range of mean flow velocity. And depending on its value, we end up with different shapes. So the number of peaks change, and also the angle of these mountains change too.
For the same packing configuration?
Yes, so it's reproducible if I keep the same packing. If I change my packing, I will basically have statistically approximately the same number of peaks for a given mean flow velocity. So it's statistically reproducible. And if I don't change my packing and start my front exactly at the same position, it's reproducible. And so those fronts stay, they will remain entirely static as long as we have the mean flow. So it's basically an out of equilibrium state, because both the reaction and the flow are working, but still the state we obtain is steady.
But it's when driving force is almost zero?
So, no, that's so I will come back to the driving force, but so it's not zero, so it's obviously small, but there is a certain range of like it can go up to more than three times of the chemical velocity. So I mean, I can still form those frozen patterns if I have a mean flow velocity which is three times the chemical velocity and adverse. So it's not that small. And here I have reported the final shape of those frozen patterns for different value of the mean flow velocity. And so one way to understand this angle is actually to come back to this Aikonol equation, and by putting here this term to zero, because the front is steady, and if we neglect also the curvature term, because those parts are quite flat, we can end up with this very simple relation. And if we measure the angle of those patterns in function of the mean flow velocity, we can see that they seem to quite nicely follow this prediction by the Econol approximation. So this angle here seems to be predicted by the Econol approximation. And another interesting thing I realized recently is actually those kind of pattern has also been observed in other system, in magnetic system. And so the way they describe the angle here actually depends on the applied magnetic field strength and the applied electric current. So basically the current is pushing the magnetic domain. It's just translating everything. And the magnetic field is flipping the domain. And so we can see here by comparing those two equations, so the only difference here is actually they measure the complementary angle here. So they have a cosinus and we measure this angle here. And so we can see very easily that the magnetic field here is playing the role of the chemical reaction. So it's flipping the magnetic domain. And the electrical current is pushing everything. And so what is, however, responsible of pinning in our system? Because in magnetic systems, usually impurities or defaults of the crystal, which leads to this pinning mechanism. So what is responsible of this in our system? So to understand that, we have performed some numerical simulations. And so this way, we have an exact equivalence between the flow velocity and the front dynamics. And so here, we can still see them. In white here, I have circled region where the flow velocity is locally smaller than the chemical reaction velocity. And so we can see here that the peak, actually, of these patterns are located at these low flow regions. And so those are responsible of the pinning of the front, and then the angle is controlled by the Econol equation. And we can see that if the mean flow is higher, so statistically we have less and less chance of finding these low flow regions, we'll see that when they have all disappeared, there is no location in the flow where we can find a region where the local flow velocity is smaller than the chemical reaction, then the front is completely washed away and goes down. And so what is interesting here is that those shapes actually are also predicted by negative quenched KPZ model. And so the negative quenched KPZ model is the case where, so we have quenched noise, which is our case when the driving force is small. And so the important thing is the nonlinear term and the driving force have opposite signs. And so in that case, the nonlinear term now is acting against the propagation direction of the front. And so this will lead to angular dependence of the front velocity such that when the front is flat, it's going down, but if it starts to be tilted, it will slow down because of this term, because this term is opposing to the propagation of the front. So here, so what I observe in my experiment is actually this, but upside down, because I'm going, I'm going backward. So what we see is we have those peaks here. And when the front is tilted, it will slow down. So that's the same thing as this, but upside down, because here the front propagates this way for the negative quenched KPZ model. But if we put everything negative here, the same things can happen upside down. And in my case, the front is propagating downward. But so everything is negative, but the chemical velocity is always positive. So that's the same thing, but with opposite signs. And one of the predictions of the negative KPZ model is that it's leading to a first-order depinning transition. So when we go from those pin state to downward propagating states, we expect having a jump in the velocity.
This is looks like a model for an interface in a random medium with an additional KPC term.
Yes.
And if one is very close to the depinning transition, isn't the KPC term irrelevant?
So in that case, no, because this is proportional to the chemical velocity in my system, and the chemical velocity is always present. It's even if F goes to zero and this goes to zero, this term exists, always exists, because it's basically the reaction. So it's never zero.
Both positive and negative.
Strongly
irrelevant.
Actually, I think this was 20 years ago, but
KPC is different from KPC. For the positive KPC, quench KPC is different from the acidic class. KPC. Are you going to show the phase diagram?
Yes.
Maybe that will be better.
Yeah. Here is the so if I define so my driving force here, which is the control parameter this way, so which is the mean vertical flow velocity plus the chemical reaction, plus here a small constant to actually adjust this zero here. So it's a very small constant. I will show you why I add this. So I have here the velocity, the mean velocity of the Fournier function of F. And so I have this plateau regime where I form those static frozen patterns. And so when F is negative, the front is going backward. And in this plateau regime, it's forming those static sawtooth. In zero, and this is how I choose my zero, I see that when I put on the flow, the front stops. It's neither going up, neither going down. At the beginning of the movie, there is no flow. And then I put on the flow, and we see that very sharply it stops. And in this region, I haven't talked about this yet, but these are very small f. So this means that the mean flow velocity is adverse, but smaller than the chemical reaction. And in this case, it's still adverse flow, but the chemical reaction can go upstream the flow, actually. And this is the region where those avalanches happens, actually. And so here we have those two KPZ branches I talk in the first part of my talk. So this is when F is large. For this part of the plateau regime, when F is negative, I have this negative KPZ part. So we also observe this first-order jump here in the velocity. So here I form the last sawtooth-shaped pattern, and then here I have a propagative front.
Negative quench, because it's supported by this.
Yeah.
Static.
And
on the right-hand side, it looks like continuous, or?
Yes.
Yeah. And so, yeah, and so in this region, we expect having something described by the positive QKPZ phenomenology.
So on the left, yeah. There's hysteresis
on the left,
jump?
On the left, yes. Here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we, hysteresis, yeah, very good question. No. I don't have, so what I've been doing in this point, I have been playing around a little bit here. And if I have a frozen pattern and then push it strongly, it will unpin. Mm. So then it goes down. But what I can do is then inject some flow and put my front again at the top, and do it again. But basically, I haven't seen hysteresis. It's just reproducible.
What is the X? How do you measure the X axis on this?
The F?
Yeah. What is the plotting that you're doing there? It's not linear, right? It's
oh yes, sorry. yeah. There is a. It's a bit.
Square root.
Yes. The reason is because if I don't plot this way, I can zoom on this region, and we can still see the beginning of the. Because actually, I have done much more experiments, so the branches can go here and up here, and then we don't see this region anymore.
So on the right, is there an exponent describing how you rise from zero velocity to non-zero velocity?
So not with the experiment, because with the uncertainty of my control parameter, here I have a too large jump. I'm not able to say precisely. I put like points here, 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 and here.
What do you expect?
So I don't know what I expect, but because I need more quantitative analysis to know what is the exponent, if there is one. But we have done simulation in this region, and so we have, like, I don't know, maybe 100 points in this region. And the exponent they have found here, it's power law of
0.8.
Yeah, this is what they found in the simulations.
As a function of F minus FC.
Yes, but... I mean, it's not reasonable to do that with the experimental data, unfortunately. It's too precise. So the critical behavior is happening in this configuration where the mean flow velocity, so it's still adverse, but now smaller than the chemical reaction. So in this case, the front can propagate upstream, so against the flow. And we can see that its dynamics is quite different and quite heterogeneous. And so this is where I will focus now. And again, if I plot the front position for different time step and report the local front velocity here, now I will see that the front stops when it's flat, kind of flat. And is more likely to advance when it's inclined. And so this is what could be predicted by the positive quenched KPZ model, where now both the nonlinear term and the driving force are of the same sign. And so now, if the front is inclined, it is more likely to advance. And so this is the case where the front velocity is positive, and the reaction velocity is positive. This is always positive, and this is what is changing in my system. And so in that case, the predicted roughness and growth exponents are different, and they are about 0.63. And so if I do the roughness and temporal fluctuation measurements, what I see is, so my critical F is about 0.56 with an uncertainty of 0.05, so it's not that precise, but still I can approach it. And so what I see is when I get closer to this point here, my roughness seems to go from the half 0.5 to this slightly higher roughness. And the same thing is observed here for the temporal fluctuations, where when I'm farther to FC plus, I have something so the same as I found for KPZ. And then when I get closer to this, I have something which gets in better agreement with QKPZ. So now I will focus on the dynamics of the front when I get close to FC plus. So, and the deepening transition we are observing in this region. So, this is in the context of course, crackling noise, Barkhausen noise. And so I have shown a few experiments, nice experiments here, but I'm not going to go into detail here. But so what is the critical behavior we have in this system? So it can be seen here if we look at the spatiotemporal fluctuations of the front. So to do so, yes.
On all your spatiotemporal map, the color code, the local velocity is renormalized. And it's by what, actually? So
the mean flow velocity. Yeah.
What do we see on this picture?
Okay. So what's happening here? We have the local front velocity in color code along the front. So this is a space that I have reported at each time steps during the experiment. So this is time. And you can see here it's a 10-hour experiment here. So this way I can have lots of statistics. And so what we see here is that the front is undergoing those burst-like events. And it's stopping and then propagating, stopping and propagating. So if we follow, for example, the local flow velocity fluctuations during time, we can see that it's quite irregular and the velocity goes several times very close or to zero several times during the experiments. But this is the local front velocity, not the global one. And so we can see here that also another information is we see those kind of diagonal shapes here who seems to indicate a lateral propagation of the front in this regime. So for example, the front stops here at this time, but then it can propagate toward the right during the next time steps. And if I vary this driving force and look at how the spatiotemporal maps change, I can see that, so when the driving force is large, I cannot really distinguish these events. And when I get closer to the critical F, I see that more and more I have those static part patches appearing and this lateral propagation phenomena. And so this is under the threshold, so this front will never reach the top of the cell. It will only propagate locally and stop. And this one is like a very close experiment, one of the closest experiments to F equals zero I have. So the fronts barely move when the flow is put on. And this is a movie of what's happening at the critical point. So what we see is the front is, for example, here, it's completely frozen. And here also, but like, laterally, it's slowly propagating from, like, reaching different location because those.
Do you have events ahead of the front nucleation? It seems like there is a spot.
Yeah.
At some point, just so.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's a perfect one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From the three-dimensionality coming around.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I think it's probably a continuous front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, where? Here?
Yeah. Big spots.
I know. So.
The beads are not opaque, right?
So yeah. That's probably one of the explanation. The other explanation is also, I only detect a gray level for the front concentration. So maybe that could be a very slow dynamics where like some autocatalysts start to produce iodine, but I don't detect it because it's not colored enough, because the concentration is too small. And then it reaches the right concentration and I can see it. It can be either this or the other one. I don't know. But one thing I have done, just to make sure that the gray level are not influencing my measurements, is I have defined my roughness exponent and the front determination for different gray level detection. So, and this way, I just make sure that I have a reliable interval where the roughness is not changing because of the way I define the front based on these gray levels detection. And so here, it seems that we have a percolation-like mechanism where the front is stopped when the local flow velocity is higher than the chemical flow velocity. So if we look at, for example, this automation model, we can simply define by zero the places where the flow velocity is too high, to the chemical reaction to goes up, and by one where it's low enough so the chemical reaction win and can goes up. And so if we can delineate a transversal path of those zero, we can stop the fronts. And here, if I look at here, for example, where the front was stopped initially and then start to move, I can try to identify avalanches this way. So I will show you right after this how I do my filtering. But if I identify each here event, so basically I look at I filter out the when the position where the front is stopped, and I look how it's moved from one frozen location to another static location, and so I basically only keep those moving parts. And so those local rearrangement here, where the front move from one stuck position to another stuck position, are highlighted here, and the color code actually represent the time. So this is a bit weird, but the reason for that is I wanted to know how the avalanche is propagating in time. And so we can see that here, for example, these events, it seems to start here. So blue mean initial time. And then I go toward the red, which mean final time. And so I can see that the avalanches in this regime seems to start when they are tilted, and then they propagate toward the right in this experiment. So this is just one way to see things. But so the way I have been analyzing my data is I start with a velocity matrix, local velocity matrix of my flow, of my front. So here I have reported all the front different front position I have measured during one experiment, and then I report the inverse of the local velocity at this position. And so this is time in second.
So it's a waiting time.
It's a waiting time matrix.
Waiting time matrix. And so I have cut here the color bar at 1 minute. But basically, so everything you see in red here means that the front has wait more than a minute before propagating again.
But it's really creeping. So what's, it looks like it's creeping over some region, right? Is that like pore size? Or I can see a big red chunk at the bottom that extends. I would expect the red to be very thin compared to the blue, right?
Yeah.
So oh, I would say it's creeping rather than it's thin.
You mean like it's, yeah, it's like very slowly propagating, probably. Yeah.
Yeah, but because Kay told me that you're not measuring the waiting time, actually. You're measuring first the velocity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I didn't say.
But it's slow, and it's slow.
It's slowly creeping, region,
right? So
yeah.
That's
why I.
It's not fully creeping.
It's difficult to say. Like, if for example here, is it pin or slowly moving? I don't know. But it's tration, so. It's a way to I at least define a threshold, so I consider it pinned under a certain amount of time, stay at the same location.
It's a pinning problem. What do you pin? What do we call that here?
What is your better actually for that?
What
do you call red or blue or green? What is your measure, what is your meaning of that kind of measure?
Like,
you say it's a certain velocity.
Yeah.
And so you have a certain distance, and then you measure the different. Your meaning is a certain distance to move forward to front, and then you measure the time for that. That would be meaning time.
What I do is.
Or you do a very certain time binning, and then you say, okay, this is such a distance, and it would be creep. But, okay.
So.
Corresponding inverse velocity.
Okay. We can just
delay. Okay.
Velocity is a continuous variable.
It is discretized by my sampling frequency, but.
You don't wait longer than 60 seconds.
Hmm?
You don't wait any longer than 60 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cut here. It can be several minutes. I have just decided to cut it for the color code here.
That's why the red is thicker than you think.
Maybe. Yeah.
I mean, if you continue it on, the red will get better.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we'll really only be pinned at one point. Is that?
I mean, it's not one pixel,
I
mean, but.
You have the data for longer, you just did it so you can see the smaller structure, right?
Yeah. So the thing is, the sampling is much higher, so I have to do this kind of mean, otherwise, I will get some noise because the font is not moving between two pictures.
The color could be log time, and then you could see all the whole range as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you could see all the way up there.
Yeah, yeah. The reason I have cut it here is because we have a better contrast actually for
exactly.
The presentation.
You might see all if you could log time.
Yes.
So the color was the log of the time.
Exactly. So actually, yeah, you're right. Like I have in the dark red region, I have more precise information than what can be seen from this picture, like in the matrix. So then I remove, I define a threshold, and so I remove those transiently stopped parts, and then I identify all those different events which are going to be the avalanches in this system. And so one important thing I needed to do this analysis was actually to make an identification between the spatial map of an experiment where we have identified all these different clusters and the spatiotemporal map of the same experiment. The reason for that is when I do this analysis, I lose the causality in my experiment. Because if I look, for example, to an avalanche, for example, I know that this is an avalanche. Okay, but now I don't have no more the information of where this event has started and where it stops. I don't know how inside this event, what's happening, where is time. And so to do this identification, I have done, I have analyzed my data such that I can identify one event in the spatial map to the corresponding event in the spatiotemporal map. And so this is how I can recover the what I call the causality inside an avalanche, such that now I know exactly when the avalanche starts, what are the velocity, a variation in time during one avalanche and where it stops. And so now I can go between those two maps and I have the full information. And so one thing I can measure this way is the mean width of an avalanche for a given duration of event. And then I do a statistical mean over all the avalanches of the same duration and define what is this mean width of the event at a given duration. And I do the same for the area of the avalanche. So this is why those equivalence between the spatiotemporal map and spatial map is important, because I can also now, I know what is the area of an avalanche of a given duration, and then I do again a statistical mean about over all my data of different, even like mixing different experiments done for the same driving force. And so this way I can plot these curves. And
do you change the granular packing when you run a new experiment?
Yes, it can be a different realization. Yes.
It should be, right? Because presumably all the pinning sites are determined by the stagnation points of the flow. Right?
Yeah. So
when you're averaging together over new granular packing.
Yeah, because I assume they are statistically equivalent. So I will have, for example, let's say, I don't know, 5 pinning sites for a given mean flow, and this should be approximately the same for the same mean flow for a different realization of packing. Yeah. And so experimentally, so we can try to verify those relation between the different exponents. So alpha is the roughness exponent of the front in this regime, which I have previously determined. And so this was about 0.66. And the z we measure, so here we have 1 over z. So this is just indicative slope of the predicted exponents. So our slope is different. But we find a z which is quite close to 1. And so the gamma we can determine from those two measurements is about 1.50, and it's quite close to what is the gamma exponent we also measure experimentally. So we have two ways of determining gamma, either by those two independent measurements or these measurements. And so far it looks quite good.
So you see that the roughness exponent that you have shown us at the very beginning, by just analyzing the scaling of the complete front, it's exactly the same as the local anisotropic shape of your avalanches, is it?
That's something I still have to measure. Like I have measured this, it's close, but I was not happy with the way I defined the roughness of my avalanche, so. I'm not showing it here, but.
But you were showing also that the roughness could evolve depending on, I don't remember now, but on your driving.
Oh, yeah, this is the case for high flow rate.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in this case, it's low flow rate, so it's not changing.
Okay, so it's not evolving.
No. Right. The evolution thing happens in the KPZ model for very high flow strength and like at long times. But I haven't observed this kind of effect for slower flow rate, and in the quenched regime, I don't observe that the roughness past a very short transient regime. Of course, there is always a small transient regime between when I start the experiment, when I put on the flow, and start to measure the roughness, but I always wait this time before doing my measurements in all the measurements I have been doing. So this is something I'm also aware of. But I agree that it's important here. This is why I write here alpha A, which is alpha avalanche, and not alpha for the front. I agree that those two objects are experimentally measured differently. And it's just because here this is still current work. So this is something I'm not yet happy with the way it's determined, because I'm not sure of how one can define the roughness of an avalanche. I know how to define the roughness of a front, but the roughness of an avalanche, I think
it's anisotropic shape.
Yeah, because some people use the bounding box method, so they basically just look at the aspect ratio of a bounding box of an avalanche, but I'm not sure if this is accurate enough compared to when we do a total roughness measurements, where we look at the standard deviation of the fluctuations. I have the feeling we lose some statistics when we do the bounding box method. I don't know. Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's something we can discuss. I mean, So I'm almost done, actually, because this is the limit of what I've been doing. So I can also, I have also started to look at the shape of those avalanches, because now I know exactly what an avalanche is in time, and I know what is the velocity fluctuation inside one event. And so I can plot the mean velocity in time for each avalanches and do then the statistical mean over a given mean duration of avalanche. And so here I have divided by the duration of the avalanche just to separate the different avalanche shapes. So the one in the bottom are the longest avalanches, so they seem to have a flatter shape. And the one on the top is like the shortest avalanches I measure.
The velocity in the beginning doesn't start at zero?
It's normalized, so I haven't, it's shifted.
Shifted?
Yeah, it started at zero if I don't divide it by t.
Well, no, the function zero, if you divide zero by something, it's still zero.
So yeah.
Is it shifted or it's divided?
There's a shift here, I know, but I don't.
Maybe you had cut off the only objectivity above some threshold or something.
Like what kind of threshold?
Like some noise, kind of. So that we never really see the
final. Oh, the very beginning or the very final of the event. Maybe, yes.
Yeah,
that's a good point. And so one last thing is actually these are what we measure for the avalanche's size and duration distribution. So this is where things are different in those experiments. So the exponent I find for the size distribution of the avalanche is something which is greater than 2, so it's very large. And the duration distribution for this avalanche, this exponent is also quite large. So I don't know why I observe these values, which are not, from my knowledge, are not predicted by any model. But still,
there are predictions for French KPC to
happen. Yeah, no, they are very different. Yeah, they are very different. Still, if we
even better. Yeah.
But I mean, are you lumping together avalanches at independent or something? If you think if you lump together avalanches at different forces, then you change the exponent.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. So. This is something, yeah, I wanted to check, but I mean, I have, experimentally, at some point, I have no choice.
Sure.
So those statistics have been done for the same driving force in the incertitude interval.
In a certain interval, yeah. There's a way to get around that.
Oh.
We can talk about
that. Oh, nice, yeah. Because at the beginning, I had more statistics, but I was like having driving force slightly different. So I was like, no, I probably should, like, it's better to lose statistics, but like, try to filter only the experiment who are the closer in driving force.
Yeah.
And, but those things, those exponents have not changed. They have slightly changed, but not that much. Like, I was hoping to have something which can be closer to the theory, but they seem quite robust. And so yeah, I mean, maybe there's something to do with data analysis or and so yeah, so or maybe I don't have enough statistics. I don't know, because those things require a huge amount of statistics, which is quite hard to get experimentally.
Can you make something very clear? The avalanche are not made of several of the clusters you show us. You are considering one avalanche is one of the clusters. to show us on this map is correct, or can you?
What do you mean?
Your set of avalanche size is taken as an avalanche, one avalanche defined as one cluster in this
yes.
diagram.
I mean, but it's a statistical mean, but.
Right, just to. Definition of avalanche is one cluster, or is it something more complex composed of different?
No, it's one cluster. Yeah, I consider like local events. Exactly.
Not local events are arriving at different. Same time, but not.
Yeah, no. I know some people like at a given time they will consider the same avalanche even events who are not connected, but that's not the case. I really separate them. Yes.
And you didn't look at the dependence of the cutoff on the driving?
And the way
I presume the bottom one is critical.
This is difficult to study experimentally.
but did you, I mean, you have chosen a given threshold to define your avalanches.
Yeah. Yes. So that's something. So I check that at the end of my PhD, but this is also something I need to do carefully. Yeah. This is very important to check that those exponents don't depend on the threshold. That's like the basic, I would say.
Thank you.
That was my question.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, this is very important. I completely agree.
Sorry.
It's finished. in conclusion, I would say it was a fun PhD because I had a we were not expecting this at all. The experiment was not built to observe those universality classes, so it was a nice surprise to observe all this rich dynamics and universal behavior. And this by changing only one control parameter. So basically, I only change the mean flow velocity in the system, and I can go through all this, so KPZ behavior for fast-moving phase, positive KPZ with those deepening behavior still need to go further, and those negative QKPZ behavior where we have those frozen sawtooth shapes. So avalanche's statistical properties are yet to be explored and currently explored. And one other thing I wanted to mention is I have a kind of avalanche event when I go backward, but I don't know how to. So here we can definitely see that the peak can also unpin and go down. So basically, we have a kind of avalanches phenomena in this negative QKPZ state. And so the event here is the one reported here in color. So
you
we see that.
You talk about the region where you get finally
you below threshold.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So where I get those final sawtooth shapes, exactly. And if I plot the avalanche again, like in time, I see that the avalanche begins here at the top and goes down. So it's a different way of avalanche propagation. It's no more transversal. It's going vertically. I don't really know how to deal with this. I don't know if there is a deepening transition or if it's a different kind of avalanches, but which doesn't go in the critical phenomenology because it's a first order transition. But there are some kind of irregular phenomena with traction, pinning, and deepening in this region too.
Okay.
Well, that's our application for complex flows. Yeah. I thank you for attention.
Okay, do you have any questions? So, anything more?
No. I have one question. I mean, in nature, where do these kind of propagating fronts play a role?
I skipped this. But yeah, many people are interested in this. So both in the case, so there are several cases actually. Both people who work with bacteria swarming, because the dynamic of a bacterial front is basically the same because there's a growth dynamics, which is due to the multiplication of bacteria. and they are coupled to hydrodynamics flow. So, and some KPC behavior have also been observed in bacteria, but in petri dish, not in flows. So I don't know how we can connect this quantitatively. But for sure, like the dynamics of autocatalytic front is analog to the dynamics of any living system. Like one of the interesting things is the plankton bloom in the ocean. They can also form patches which dynamics results from the coupling between the plankton dynamics, the growth dynamics of the front, plus the chaotic advection of the ocean currents. And so in this context, some people have been doing experiments in cellular flow, in chaotic flow with vortices. And by using the same kind of chemical reaction to reproduce this plankton behavior. Another maybe more direct application in nature is also the ozone hole. The ozone hole is like a reaction which is not autocatalyst, but only catalyst. So it's catalyzed by a species. It's not self-sustained, but it's catalyzed. So it's still, that's why it's so hard to get rid of. It remains in this place because it has also a kind of catalysis dynamics. And it's coupled with the giant vortex flow of the South Pole. So this is also a case of where we have a nonlinear dynamic front coupled with some hydrodynamics.
Thank you.
No question?
Okay.